TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg.
We will be there. Come with us.
Your official home of the Winnipeg Jets.
A division of Bell Media.
If you want to know the real deal about the three, put them in the deck with triple chop. We're going to bring you up to speed.
TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live online at tsn1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in the studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday afternoon. Joining us in about 30 minutes' time from the Vancouver province, Ben Kuzma, to talk about the Canucks' reported hiring of John Tortorella as their new head coach. At 1 o'clock, you know him from Sports Illustrated, you know him from TSN, the reporters, and he's a Hockey Hall of Fame journalist. Michael Farber is going to be joining us to talk about the new TSN documentary coming out on Tuesday, Neutral Zone. 1:15, Frank Provenzano, former assistant general manager of the Dallas Stars. 2 o'clock, Grant Saunier, general manager of the Charlottetown Islanders, to talk about the QMJHL draft prospects. We'll, of course, be at the draft next Saturday and Sunday here on TSN 1290. Richie Inezzi and Dave Manuk from IllegalCurve.com will be there. I'll be back here in Winnipeg holding down the fort. 2:30, Bradley Clayton, a scout for the Dubuque Fighting Saints of the United States Hockey League, to talk about the draft prospects from the United States Hockey League. As you can see, it is a busy 3 hours. Without further ado, Richie Inezzi, good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
Good afternoon. Yeah, it does seem like it's going to be a jam-packed show. There's so much to talk about, aside from the fact that this series between the Chicago Blackhawks and Boston Bruins is turning into an absolute classic. Roy McGregor wrote about it in the Globe and Mail, how that 6-5 game was what hockey's all about. It was really a game where the game went back to the players. And it really was a classic. Everybody was talking about it the next day, but you know, we have so much to talk about. I'm ready to go. Hit me with whatever you got, Drew.
I might just hit you. How about I do it? Richie?
You might as well like that 6-5 game, because if today is anything over 3-2, I'll be shocked.
Well, that was going to be my first question. Let's start with the series. Game 5 tonight between the Blackhawks and the Bruins. You know, series tied 2-2. It's now down to a best of 3. First question, offensive output in Game 4, was that an aberration or a sign of things to come?
An aberration. I think what happens is you get caught up in the game, and I think from Boston's perspective specifically, they cannot get involved in a game like that if they want to win. They had a chance to win that game. Obviously, there were chances in overtime before Seabrook's goal. But at the end of the day, Boston's structure and the way they play the game is their key to success. Chicago would play those games all the time. They can skate and score. So Boston played into what Chicago wanted. So Chicago will try and do that again today. I just don't see Boston playing into it. And so I think that was uncharacteristic of the Bruins. And I think if they want to win the Cup, and if they are going to win the Cup, they cannot engage in a game like that again.
Did they just get caught up in the moment? Is that largely what it was?
You do, Drew. And you're playing these big games, and you're down, and then you get up. I mean, you tie it, and you back and forth, and you have to open up a bit when you get down. That's one of the factors here, and the Bruins get behind. Every team in the league is different when they're behind, but the Bruins specifically are very different. So it's nice for them to come back and prove to themselves that they can do that. And obviously, they did it against the Leafs. But overall, I mean, that's, you just get into the momentum of the game, and then you kind of stop listening to the coach, and chances one way, chances the other way. So you have to play more disciplined to win. It's not aesthetically pleasing for the fans. That's a great game, 6-5. That's the way, and Roy McGregor says it, you know, hockey should be played, not as much structure and all that. But the realities of the situation are that's very unlikely to happen once again tonight.
You know, if you call that game a beautiful, chaotic mess, when you try to make sense of the game, mm-hmm. though, the Chicago Blackhawks were in complete control of that game. You could even say they were dominating that game after Patrick Kane made it 3-1. And then shortly after that, Patrick Sharp had a 2-on-1. He had 2 2-on-1 chances in the second period. Tuukka Rask made a great save, which allowed Milan Lucic to score that second goal, and then they later tied it up. But Chicago was in a position that game should have been should have been over. It could have been 4-1. It could have even been 5-1 at certain points. That game shouldn't have gone to overtime. You know, credit Boston for coming back in that game. One thing we know about the Boston Bruins guys is that they could be down by 5 goals and it doesn't matter. And that's a scary thing for Chicago, but what happens when you do that is you get away from what you're good at. The Boston Bruins play a very controlled game, and we've talked about this for almost 4 months now, since the season started back in February, the Boston Bruins play their system better than anybody maybe we've seen in a long time, maybe since even the New Jersey Devils. I'm a little biased there, as you guys know, but the Boston Bruins are so good, and their defense is so good. We've talked about how good their forwards are for covering up mistakes, and Chicago was using their speed so good that even a guy like Patrice Bergeron wasn't even able to come back. You remember that Marcus Kruger goal, and they were just all over the ice, and they were using that stretch pass, and I don't think the Boston Bruins want to get into that type of game again in Chicago. They want to take the crowd out of early. They want to, you know, get back to playing their defensive style of hockey. But when you try to make sense of it, the Chicago Blackhawks really let that game get away, and there should have never been a situation where that game went to overtime. But you know, Crawford was god awful. He couldn't stop a beach ball, and you know they didn't capitalize on a couple of odd man rushes. But you know, to think that you know we're going to see 11 goals again in the series, I think is probably not something that you should expect.
We might not see 11 goals total in the next three games goes that far.
And I think it will. And I do think that Claude Julien likes the position he's in terms of team shows hard to come back, but he can use it as a building block and as an example of how they cannot play. So he can build on the fact that they were resilient, but also point to the fact that they did not win and can't play that way.
Right.
So I think that plays right into his wheelhouse. And I think if you watch the post-game press conference, he was very controlled. He wasn't that emotional. And I thought that you could kind of see how he was viewing the game in terms of a learning experience. The second thing to point out is the two-day break is huge for Chara because he looked worn down. I love what Quenneville did with putting Kane and Bickle up there with Taves, giving Taves talent and saying, forget about Chara, we're going to go at him. And I think, you know, Bickle's acknowledged in his NHL.com blog, his purpose is to try and get Chara off of his game and open up space for Kane and Taves.
Were they successful in Game 5
that? Of course they were successful. I mean, it was the best game they played, and that was Charles' worst, and I think those kind of go hand in hand, to be honest with you. But 2 days off, a little more structure. I think tonight that matchup is going, as we know, it's interesting and the most important. But, you know, how does Chara react to playing a poor game and maybe being tired but having 2 days off? Does Chicago build in the momentum of having that top line rolling and, you know, obviously having Hossa back?
Is Chicago now taking the sort of the perspective, you know, for the first at least three games, it was we have to try and keep our best players away from Chara. Is Chicago now taking the perspective, doesn't matter, we're going to load up, and if they throw Chara at us, our three best players, in this case Kane, Taves, and Bickle, are better and can mitigate whatever Chara does in his place?
They were playing the Blackhawks were playing too much on the defensive.
That's right.
They had to get going in game the difference between game 3 and game 4 was really night and day. You had so few scoring chances and the decision making was so much quicker in game 4 for the Chicago Blackhawks. They were really using their D, getting their D involved, right, and they were really using their speed through the neutral zone, something that is extremely difficult to do against the Boston Bruins because they have the puck. And the thing is, what they've done is they've taken that away. And now the game ended up going back and forth, but early on in that game, it was all Chicago, and they were on the offensive, and you really haven't seen that against the Boston Bruins from any team. One of the big problems for the Pittsburgh Penguins was they just couldn't generate any offense. They couldn't get anything going. They were getting shots. Everything was from the outside. The Boston Bruins are so good at keeping everything to the outside, and I think that they were almost forced to put Taves and Kane together to get them going. Because Quenneville himself said that he didn't really want to load up that first line, but then you put some size out there with Brian Bickle. And you know what? Brian Bickle's an effective guy, and I know we're going to talk about free agents later, guys, but he's been an impact player in every series. He really has.
He's a pending unrestricted
pending
free
UFA.
Agent.
Yeah. He has been an impact player. I think he got 2 points in that game. He got at least an assist on Kane's goal there. But he's really found a line there that's working. Now, you know, Hossa's not 100% healthy, and that's a concern, and they might have to switch up the lines again. But I think he's found a line there that's working, because Taves and Kane, those guys had to get going. Taves had to get a goal, and that was easily his best game of the series. And he's got to be successful in order for them to win this series.
You need to be able to play best on best. And I kind of think people get too obsessed with the matchups. And Quenneville got too obsessed with it. Kruger and Frolik playing with Taves. He was overthinking it, mm-hmm. and he was showing that he was a bit intimidated. As he said, you just got to let him play. And Taves needs to go up against Chara and beat him. If he's that good, if he's one of the top three, four centers in the National Hockey League, which you can certainly argue that he is, I would argue that he is, he's got to beat Chara. Best players beat the best players, you know. And I think he challenged Taves in a way, gave him help, of course, with Kane and Bickle, but he challenged Taves in a way. And I think that Taves, not surprisingly, reacted and flat with flying colors.
Well, from my perspective, I mean, you know, you're not worried about who's Chara's partner defensively for the most part. So when you don't load up a top line, you know, you're playing into Chara's strength. You know, Chara versus Taves and two mediocre players is a matchup I'll take. Yeah. Chara and defensive partner X versus Taves and Kane and Bickle, who's really coming into his own, I'll take Chicago in that matchup.
The concern that Quenneville probably had before this is, you know, Hossa's injured. Whether he's certainly not playing 100%, how good, what percent he's at, we're not sure. So are you loading up that line and then essentially relying on Patrick Sharp, who played well, to provide your secondary scoring because Bolin really hasn't gotten much done and some of the other guys haven't contributed as much as they'd like? And that's his concern. And so his concern is Chara and those guys shut him down, and then Boston's Krejci line dominates the other lines on Chicago and they lose. And that could happen tonight. So I understand the perspective. But good players need to play with good players. And that balanced approach only lasts for so long. You're only as good as your line mates, and I think you can't be putting Kruger and Frolik, whoever it is. It needs to be best players. Need to play with the, and need to, and that's the thing, is that Chicago is kind of missing that second line center, right? So you put Kane with somebody else. I mean, Hanzus is respectable in terms of, you know, defensively and faceoffs generally, although he got killed by Bergeron and the Bruins centers this series. You put him with a guy like that, he's slower, not very offensive, so you're kind of playing a two-man game up front. Can't have that.
I mean, nobody expected Michael Hanzus to be the Blackhawks' second-line center at this point.
He's been fantastic.
He has been, but when they acquired him, I mean, they acquired him for...
Third line, maybe fourth line.
Exactly.
The big concern for me coming out of that game, and they were talking about this on TSN two nights ago, is Nick Leddy wasn't playing at all, and they were going to five defensemen. Now, it turned out that wasn't hurting them a lot. I think he ended up with 4 or 5 minutes. Maybe one of you guys can check that here. But
yeah, it was about... It was very low. That.
It was less than a few minutes in the first period especially, but Quenneville has lost confidence in Nick Leddy, but I didn't think Johnny Oduya had his best game. Roosevelt turned out to be a guy that was ended up playing, I think it was over 20 minutes, a guy who's usually on that last pairing with Leddy. But that was a concern for me. And Crawford, you know, we've been talking about this since game four, the glove hand. And, you know, it is a major concern. Because you guys know, I picked Chicago to win the Cup before the season started. I picked them, you know, to win the Cup, and I still think they are going to win the series. But Crawford, you can't let in some of those goals. Goal was bad. They were all bad.
Hold that thought. I want to talk about Corey Crawford, but I want to do it after these commercial messages. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Elevator music here.
I like it.
It's good.
We put a lot of pressure on producer Tim at the start of the show. He said we want some good music today. He's coming through big so far.
So what's this Daft song?
Not crazy.
Well, it's a good start. It's a good start. This segment of the show is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 25 years, Rumors has been in Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Rumors is closed this weekend. Unfortunately, they fell victim to a little bit of the water that the southwest part of the city got over the weekend. Hoping to be back open for next Tuesday. So, you know, what you should do is save your laughter. that you were planning on using this weekend at Rumors and start again Tuesday at Rumors Comedy Club. Hopefully they're back up and running. Reminder, Steve-O from Jackass will be there in August. So, you know, still plenty of great comedians to check out at Rumors Comedy Club. Check them out, rumorscomedyclub.com. And while we're at it, thoughts and prayers with everybody in Calgary.
Absolutely.
Suffering through the flooding right now. And anybody in Winnipeg as well who experienced some flooding based on the torrential downpour that happened on Thursday evening.
I was going to crack a joke, but then you mentioned what's going on in southern Alberta. So it's kind of tough to follow that up with a joke, because what's happening there is absolutely horrible. And our thoughts are with everybody there. But I was going to say Rumors, our big sponsor.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you know, it was flooded and a couple of our friends were enjoying a performance there on Thursday, but if you're up on stage and it starts flooding, like, do you make a joke about that, or, you know, like, do you take advantage? Is that situational comedy, or do you just kind of let it go?
And I just don't. I don't think that's in the manual for a comedian. The comedian manual. I don't think that's one of the like, you know, there's a flow chart. Place starts to take water on. Where do you go from there? And I'm not sure that's in there. Anyways, Rumors will be back up and running in no time flat, and they are your home for comedy here in the city of Winnipeg. Continuing on our discussion about the Stanley Cup Final, Game 5 tonight, as you started talking about Corey Crawford, and you started talking about his glove hand, or lack thereof, because it was pretty invisible in Game 4.
Yeah.
You know, if you're the Blackhawks, and you saw, I mean, you escaped from that game by the skin of your teeth, a game you really should have had handily, how much confidence do you have in Corey Crawford, and if he comes out and he maybe lets in a shaky goal to start, is it Ray Emery time?
People have to calm down. I mean, the goals weren't great.
Okay, people, calm down.
Yeah, the Peverly goal's awful, but like, let's be honest here. Last week, he was supposed to be the starting goaltender for Team Canada, and today it's, do we replace him with Ray Emery? It's one game. He's been incredible otherwise. I mean, is he the best goalie in the league? No. Does he play on a team that carries the play for the most part, and teams are chasing, and they don't, you generally control the play? Yeah. So he has a benefit of playing on a really good team, and I think his numbers reflect that in a sense. But he's been very good this playoffs. He has one bad game. In Game 4 of the Stanley Cup Finals, he's taken them the whole way, and do we put in Ray Emery? Emery hasn't played in 2 months. See how he plays today? If he lets in 7 goals, okay, maybe, because he literally can't stop anything now. But a solid, fine game today, even a 75% game for his standards, he's taken you the whole way. You don't just get rid of him.
Corey Crawford is starting Game 5, first of all, and there's a strong chance he's going to start Game 6, and if there's a Game 7. You know, he had a really bad game. The first goal was weak, and he has a weakness on the glove side, and they've tried to downplay it, and they've talked about how Chicago's goalie coach Stefan Wade is working with him, and, you know, they're going to work on a few things, and he's not going to let in 5 goals again. He most likely won't, but he's been their goalie the whole season. You know, Emery played 25 games or whatever, or not 25, probably 20, and Crawford has played all of the playoff games, but he's the goalie now, and you're not going to start tinkering with your goalies in Game 5.
No.
You know, the reality is none of the guys on the Blackhawks are going to throw him under the bus and say that we've lost confidence in him. But you have to think that when they're out there and a guy had a bad game, sure, they might be thinking about it, but it's their job to also help their goalie out. And, you know, some of the goals were worse than others. But it's up to him to get better. But he's their guy at this point. I mean, you know, they've won.
Yeah.
They're living and dying by Crawford. And, you know, Richie and I disagreed about this earlier in the season, and I almost said that they'd have to go out and get a goaltender. They've decided to go with Crawford. He's been good enough. And again, Antti Niemi is a better goalie. Richie and I were talking about this off-air. Antti Niemi, when they won the cup in 2010, I think we'd all agree he was a better goalie, but he didn't steal that cup for them.
No.
He wasn't. I don't think you would call Niemi a top 5 goalie, maybe even top 10 goalie.
They obviously didn't think much of him because they let him go in free agency.
They didn't give him a 5-year contract, Drew.
Yeah. They were cap squeezed.
Right.
And, I mean, he's in the Vezina. He's a Vezina nominee this year. So
I think he deserved to be, but
anyway, he's a really good goaltender. I don't think Crawford's as good, but Crawford isn't bad. He's been very good this playoffs.
Crawford started 28 games in the regular season, and Emery started 19 games in the regular season. At this point in time,
let me bring something up for a second. Sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
If you put a new goalie in, what do you think communication happens for wraparounds the boards on forechecks?
Yeah.
What about communicating defense to defense and the goalie yelling out this, the goalie yelling the penalty kill? these are things that they've played with Emery all year, but it's been so long, you're in a flow.
Yep.
You know, maybe Emery goes behind, and Emery can sometimes be make some bad decisions, plays the puck, and he plays it to the wrong guy. They get let in a goal, and they lose. I mean, you've gone the way you've gone. I want to kind of look at it this way, too. If Duncan Keith is minus four and gets burnt for three goals, like, are you putting in the seventh defenseman? You putting in, what's his name? I'm trying to forget his name. Brookbank?
No.
I mean, it's in all honesty, it's been one game, okay? Maybe if a guy has four or five bad games in a row, you drop him down to a different pairing, or you drop him down to a different line. But it's been one game, and people have to overanalyze goalies. You just got to give him a break here. Overall, in the playoffs, he's been pretty good. And those overtime games, guys,
yep.
He was excellent. Yeah. I think the Bruins outplayed them in both overtime games. The first two, I mean.
I thought the Bruins outplayed them in the overtime game on Wednesday, too. I mean, if you look at probably the majority of the play in Wednesday's overtime, it was in the Blackhawks' end. I mean, he didn't necessarily look confident making the saves in overtime, but he made them.
He's a puck stopper.
Yeah.
I mean, that's his thing. Yep. I mean, he gives up a lot of rebounds. Yep. He doesn't look pretty all the time. But they don't ask how, they just ask if.
That's right.
Hey, and another thing. Fewer wasn't Patrick Roy either. When the Oilers were winning all those Stanley Cups, the games were 7-5 and 6-3, 6-4. They make big saves. And to a certain degree, the Chicago Blackhawks play more of an offensive style and than the Bruins do especially. And they don't rely on him as much as they do Rask.
Right.
And they make Rask look good. But, you know, if they were going to go to Ray Emery, they would have done that in the first round.
Best of three now. You got three, at most, three games left.
Yep.
Season will be over by next Wednesday at the absolute latest. Who's in the driver's seat?
I don't think any team's in the driver's seat right now, actually. I mean, aside from Chicago having two of three at home, I don't think so. I think that this series is as even as it gets.
How can you say anybody's in the driver's seat, pardon me, when three of the first four games have gone to overtime? And I'm not saying that in a bad way. It's great for fans. Mm-hmm. This series so far, Drew, I think has been... you know, if you want to give it a grade, I think it's been an A-plus so far.
Yeah, with the exception of Game 3 was pretty dull.
It was dull, but, you know, when you look at the first four games, and not every game is going to go to overtime, right? But when you look at last game almost made up for the dull Game 3, right?
Yeah,
like Game 3, I agree, it was boring, a 2-0 game, not a lot of goals, but Game 4 was so exciting, and Games 1 and 2 obviously went to overtime, but I don't think... I know I interrupted Richie here, I'll let Richie get back in here, but I really do think this is... a series that could go either way at this point, and it's not you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out because of how close the games have been and the fact that Boston looks. I was watching that game thinking to myself, okay, the Chicago Blackhawks have finally woken up. Mm-hmm. Taves gets a goal, Kane gets a goal, Sharp had that 2-on-1, but you know it was 3-1. Thinking to myself, okay, they're probably going to end up winning this game by two or three goals, but then Boston finds a way to come back, and we know that they're resilient. And even though Claude Julien probably doesn't want to play that type of game, they can play that game. They can trade chances. They've proven that with Chicago. But I think they're going to want to get back to keeping those scores a little bit lower.
I think it's a 7-game series. I think it's a 1-goal game in Game 7. I mean, it's going to be a flip of a coin here, really. I think the Bruins can play on the road, too. So I wouldn't be shocked if the Bruins won Game 5 and Blackhawks won Game 6. And I wouldn't be shocked if it was the opposite there in terms of home ice. I honestly wouldn't. Both these teams are good enough to win on the road. They're not intimidated. They're confident. They have good coaches. You're talking about two powerhouses here, and I think sometimes, you know, I've had a number of people say to me, boy, you see how far away the Jets are when you watch these teams play. And it's true. Mm-hmm. Because these teams are, there's no Cinderella, as we talked about. Four best teams I thought were in the conference finals. The two best teams are in the final, and they're proving why. So, flip a coin.
After Game 3, we saw the adjustments that the Blackhawks made
mm-hmm.
in terms of, you know, loading up that top line. How does Boston counter? What kind of adjustments does Boston make today?
It's just playing a more disciplined game, and maybe you're going to see Soderberg instead of Daugavins. I like that. Daugavins can do a lot of stuff but not finish. I don't mind giving Soderberg a chance on the fourth line there.
Carl Soderberg in the lineup up front instead of
Soderberg hasn't played Daugavins. A game yet. They signed him late in the regular season. He hasn't played a game yet in the playoffs.
And he's a guy who's got skill.
It's the fourth line guys we're talking about, so they're not
difference
makers.
I mean, he's not going to be fourth line eventually, but he's fourth line now.
Right, now.
Yeah, but, I mean, hey, Daugavins could have scored in overtime.
Mm-hmm.
In those games, he's had chances. He's kind of like a dangler. And
he's got good speed, but not a lot of finish.
Yeah, he's got no finish, exactly. So, I mean, I don't mind the switch there, change it up a little bit. He's got good support with the wingers. Maybe you trust that line a little bit more. I don't know. because they've played around the third, fourth lines. But I think it's just a matter of discipline, Drew. It's a matter of not chasing as much. It's a matter of supporting the puck. I know all the catchphrases, but I think it's true in terms of Boston's game. They talk about the layering. I think one thing Chicago's done a really good job of is getting through the neutral zone with a one man, meaning the defenseman or forward. Defenseman skates it up, or the forward comes back, picks it up, and instead of making what generally teams do is a cross-ice pass and tip it into the offensive zone and forecheck, the Blackhawks have been doing a pretty good job of having their forward come back, take the puck, and go through a player or two with speed, then gain the red line, and then have options. And I think the Hawks have been using their speed in that regard quite well.
Game 5 tonight, 7 o'clock puck drop. It'll be an interesting one. It'll be very... I mean, this is a great series, like you guys mentioned. And it's anybody's series with a maximum of 3 games to go. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to go out to the West Coast, Vancouver, talk to Ben Kuzma of the Vancouver province about the Canucks reportedly set to hire John Tortorella as their new head coach. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, live on TSN 1290.
Gunners returning home like a hungry runaway. He walks the town all alone.
Little Bruce Springsteen bringing us back from break here on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're trying to get a hold of Ben Kuzma from the Vancouver province. I'm sure we'll... Oh, looks like we got him on the line. So let's go to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Ben Kuzma from the Vancouver province. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. How are you, Ben?
Not a problem being back. How are you doing today?
Doing very well. Thanks very much. Right. Ben, I mean, we got to ask. Why John Tortorella as the new head coach of the Vancouver Canucks, if that does come to fruition?
Well, I think the one thing that everybody can agree with the Canucks, whether it's the general manager Mike Gillis or owner Francesco Aquilini, is that they were looking for a new voice. They were certainly looking for a new direction. You know, after being swept by the San Jose Sharks and, you know, winning one playoff game the last two springs, does not sit well with anybody here, especially ownership. And you should know that ownership was very involved in this process. I mean, Francesco Aquilini has spent to the cap here, has given this club every creature comfort you can imagine, from, you know, sleep doctors to mind rooms to chefs to a fancy lounge to making sure their travel works with the schedule. So he didn't get much in return. And, you know, there's not an owner around the league that doesn't want to get to that second round when, you know, that playoff revenue goes in your jeans. And a lot of angst in this town about the performance of a veteran-laden team. So to answer your question about John Tortorella, I think there was a lot of interest here from afar, even when Tortorella was still coaching the Rangers. I first heard about this 6 or 7 weeks ago, that there was, from above, that there was an admiration for what Tortorella does, in the sense that the message has to change here in Vancouver, that there is a comfort level within a veteran-leading team that kind of sets its own performance bar from within the room. And you're not going to get that with John Tortorella. He's going to be in your face. He's going to try to temper his approach, and his second interview was all about that. But, you know, John is John. He's still going to drop the F-bombs. But I think the important thing here in Vancouver, once this all becomes official, is that, you know, he's going to have the foil. He's going to have the white hat, need a white hat guy on that staff to help him temper the message a little bit, because, you know, it's not New York. You know, we don't have a Major League Baseball team. You know, we don't have the NFL or the NBA. I mean, the Lions and the Whitecaps get their due share of coverage here in Vancouver, but hockey is king, and everything John says or does is going to be front page news, or it's going to be on talk radio or on TV. So that's an important part of this process. You know, the second interview was all about that. Can John bring a different approach? And it'll be interesting to see if they do something like they did when he was in Tampa, when he had Ramsey there as his assistant when they won the Cup in 04. You know, people tend to lose sight of the fact that the Rangers were in the conference final in 2012. It's not like suddenly John doesn't know how to coach anymore. And I think everything that he brings to the table, in terms of the direction and what the ownership was looking for. And quite frankly, you know, if Mike Gillis was of the mind that maybe John Stevens, the assistant coach in Los Angeles, who has a previous history of being a head coach in Philly, was, you know, it was a 1-1-8 race, and Stevens might have been a strong guy here because he knows the game very well. He's very articulate. He's learned from different regimes, new school, old school, how to work with people, and did a great job with the Kings the last 2 years of running the back end. you also have to look at the Canucks as an aging team, and you've got to win now. And if you're trying to change the message, and you're trying to win now, and you're trying to fill some of those empty seats, and people lose sight of the fact that there were empty seats at Rogers Arena, even in the playoffs, that they had to go in a stark different direction, and that's John Tortorella.
Ben, you've alluded to it. At the end of the day, was this Mike Gillis's hire or Francesco Aquilini's hire?
I've been writing all along that ownership is extremely involved in this process, and I would have to say that because I've been led to believe that Francesco is even sitting in on the meetings or taking very involved, it obviously has to be his hiring, that it has to be in concert with where the team is going. I mean, you're not going to bring in a guy and say, I'm going to hire this guy because I'm the owner of the team without understanding where your team is at in terms of the window with the opportunity to win and how that would work within your hockey operations department. You know, what it does for Mike Gillis is it gets him a guy who might be good in the short term. And I think the next big thing, the next curiosity here in Vancouver, obviously, is going to be the contract. I mean, Alain Vigneault got the 5-year, $10 million contract to become the new coach of the Rangers, and Tortorella could easily say, well, you know, there's the benchmark. But having said that, he may get the money, but he might not get the term because, mm-hmm. you know, you look at it the next 2 or 3 years here being crucial for the Canucks. So that's going to be an interesting thing to watch. But, you know, that's the hot question in Vancouver. You know, who hired this guy? You wouldn't, it wouldn't be a stretch to suggest that it was the owner and not the general manager.
Ben, when Gary Lawless tweeted out that it looked like the Vancouver Canucks were close to signing John Tortorella, well, at first I was extremely sick to my stomach. But second of all, I thought to myself, how is John Tortorella going to handle the Sedin twins? As far as the Sedin twins go, how good of a match do you think that is for John Tortorella? And is he going to start off the season by benching them?
No, I think everybody... Here's the thing about Tortorella. Everybody sees Tortorella through a very narrow lens. I mean, how many times have you flipped on the TV and all you see is his fencing with the media? I mean, people tend to forget he's a pretty good coach. You know, he was the assistant coach for the U.S. Olympic team here in Vancouver. And you talk to a guy like Ryan Kessler, who played for Team USA, and just raved about his interaction with Tortorella. The guy can coach. It's just that, like I said, there's no filter. Nobody's filtering the message. I mean, here in Vancouver, we had Vigneault and Bonas forever. And, you know, they're like an old married couple behind the scenes. They would argue. But when they came out before us, there was a united front. I don't know who's going to be the associate coach here. I'm not sure who the assistant coach is going to be here. I mean, Scott Arneal still has 2 years left on his deal. He's sitting there in Winnipeg not knowing whether he's coming to Vancouver or is he packing to be the head coach in Utica. He doesn't know. And I've talked to Scott several times. He was pretty closely aligned with Vigneault. So, we don't know where he fits in this picture right now. And that's, we're anxious to see that. But, you know, getting back to Tortorella, I think here's what the Vancouver Canucks room was like. I mean, yes, you had a veteran core that set the accountability bar. And there's a comfort factor that comes within that because if you're the Sedins or some of the guys in that room, you're basically running the room when, you know, whether you win or lose and you go with that. But you also have, you know, other guys in that room who are really looking for direction. And you have some younger players who are coming on the scene now who really need that direction. So as far as the Sedins are concerned, I mean, they're 32 years old. They're still trying to win. There's a new voice, a new direction. And I think a lot of it's going to be predicated on the way Tortorella wants to play the game. I mean, I don't think you can totally change the way a team plays its game. But, you know, when he was in Tampa, you know, his big credo was, you know, safe as death. I don't think it's going to be fire wagon hockey in Vancouver, mm-hmm. but they've got to find a way to generate more offense, which was a problem in New York. I mean, Lundqvist had to make 40 saves. They had to block a bunch of shots. They had to try to generate their offense. They were 4-for-44 in the power play in the postseason. Brad Richards was demoted and didn't play. And we know the Gablik situation and Lundqvist was outspoken. These things are going to occur in the ebb and flow of any team. But as long as you've got somebody else on staff who can help you handle that, that's going to be imperative. You guys might phone me in the fall after I've had a number of interactions with Tortorella, and maybe I'll have another story to tell you. But I believe in a clean slate. I believe in finding out what the guy's all about. I've always been told by, if you ask John Tortorella a good question, you'll get a better answer. You ask him a dumb question, then you better brace yourself. So I think for those of us in the media here are kind of anxious to see how this is all going to play out.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're joined by Ben Kuzma of the Vancouver Province discussing the potential, sounds like inevitable, hiring of John Tortorella to be the new head coach of the Vancouver Canucks. Ben, we've talked a lot about his interactions with the media, and you mentioned that his second interview with the Canucks focused largely on that topic. You know, mm-hmm. Does he understand the error of his ways in New York, or is he just still going to go back? Is that going to be his fallback position, you know, going forward?
Yeah, I've talked quite a bit in the last month here to people who know John and or have covered John for 10 years, and they said, listen, he understands that, you know, this is probably it. I mean, he's running out of chances. He turns 55 next week. Not a lot of opportunities out there. He gets it that you know, he's running out of chances, and this is a good one. Is he still going to go to a default position and drop the odd F-bomb? Probably. I mean, that's going to be inevitable, but it's, you know, maybe it's a 12-step withdrawal program that he's going to have to slowly understand that, you know, there has to be a give and take with the media. And, you know, kind of like an addict, you try to get off an addiction to basically just go off because he hasn't had that foil. He hasn't had somebody there to help him temper the message. So it's going to be interesting. I don't think he's going to be enrolling in any programs, but he's a proud, fiery guy. And like you mentioned there, that second interview was all about that. So that, coupled with the fact that this might be his last chance to get this kind of a position, you would think he will probably conduct himself a little differently.
We're discussing this a little earlier, Ben. You know, at the end of the day, do you think that Tortorella is going to change his style to suit the roster, or do you think the Canucks are going to change their style to accommodate him?
Yeah, you think you're like, you know, as a coach, you usually like to see what you've got there and then try to formulate a game plan after that. I mean, you know, Lindy Ruff was a finalist here as well, but you know, before he took the Dallas job, and you know, with Lindy playing defense, was spending a lot of time in the offensive zone, and I'd like to think that there's something there with the Canucks where you don't want to play a chip and chase game when you've got the Sedins. You want to play a puck possession game. And you know, the funny thing with the Canucks, if you watched them in Game 4 that series with San Jose, when they were doing so much more off the rush, they were gaining the offensive zone. They weren't just simply dumping the puck in the corner and hoping to be the first guy there, or simply cycling the puck around the back of the net and hoping for the best. They look like the Canucks of 2011. I'd like to think there's some happy medium there in terms of, you know, being respectful of the way you have to play behind your blue line, but also understand you've got to do something offensively. I mean, the Canucks were 19th in offense and 22nd on the power play. That's not going to fly in realignment. There's no gimme anymore with the Canucks getting that automatic third seed. It's going to be really tough. So I think that's going to be a lot of the process this summer, understanding what they have, where they hope to go, because they don't have a lot of flexibility. They're already at the cap. They need to sign 7 more guys. They got some flexibility in terms of trade or two or who they might buy out, but this is going to be a very familiar-looking team.
If you're a Canucks fan, do you look at the Rangers and say, well, they had a good goalie, they had a really good puck-moving defenseman, they had a lot of skill up front, yet he still played that style? Does that concern a fan or concern, you know, some analysts in the area?
I think it concerns, and I think you guys brought up a valid topic. I mean, he had his differences with Gabrick, he's had his differences with Nash, you know, Richards. I mean, you've got to get it doesn't matter who you are, what team you're coaching. I mean, you've got to get your leaders to send them. You've got to get the message to them, and they've got to sell it in the room. You may show up in the room, but they've got to sell it. And the business might be meeting with Henrik and Daniel Sedin, his first player meetings, to get them to buy into what he's trying to do, that the message is going to change, the temperament of the message is going to change, the accountability factor is really going to change, and they've all got to be comfortable with that. And I believe the Sedins are professionals. You know, they played for different coaches here. I mean, it's not just been Vigneault the last 7 years. I mean, you know, Mark Crawford had his days too. So it'll be interesting to see how they adjust to that. But I think that might be one of his first player meetings.
Ben, you mentioned Lindy Ruff earlier, and sure, we heard about John Stevens, and you mentioned mm-hmm. Scott Arneil as well as being a potential head coach candidate. But because it looks like John Tortorella is going to be the coach, it's kind of a moot point. But if you were in the GM seat, who would be your first choice? Who would you hire as the Vancouver Canucks head coach?
I always thought it was going to be John Stevens. From my perspective of a guy who has been a head coach in a tough market like Philadelphia, had some success at the minor league level, had some success in Philadelphia where, you know, the media is really difficult on the coach and the team, mm-hmm. had to handle star players, brought young players along really well, communicated well, went to Los Angeles in a role with Daryl Sutter and worked with the back end, got Drew Doughty to get his, you know, his head and his game back in order. You look at a young guy like Muzzin, he brought him along. That's why I thought it was probably Stevens number one. But again, this comes into changing the message. I think what you would get in John Stevens is a lot of the, you know, organization articulate guy who works well with everybody. But the reason John Tortorella is here is because they were looking for a stark change. They want to go in another direction in terms of the message. It has to be more direct. It has to be more forceful. And there has to be a greater level of accountability. And sure, there was, you know, ownership involvement in that because, like I said earlier, Francesco Aquilini is not a happy man, and he's looking for just to go in a different direction that will not only gain the players' attention, but, you know, let's be honest, there'll be a curiosity here in Vancouver. And when you keep flaming out in the postseason, you know, I know the players play the game, but you want to give the fans some belief that the team is going in a different direction from behind the bench.
Ben Kuzma of the Vancouver Province, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. It ought to be an interesting year there in Vancouver.
Okay, guys. Yeah, it will be. I'm sure we'll be talking again.
And I'm sure, and we'll get to see you in Winnipeg this year for the first time.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that, actually.
Likewise, Ben. Take care.
Thanks, Ben.
Okay, guys.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Let's go to break. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thank you to Ben Kuzma of the Vancouver Province for having just joined us on the show to talk about John Tortorella.
During the break,
we're going to continue discussing the hirings.
I don't know if this is safe.
As he decided to put his coffee between his headphones and then knocked the headphones over and smoked the coffee all over the headphones, so he's wearing coffee-drenched headphones.
That's not what happened. Richard gets up during the break and starts, you know, creating all this room for Richard. He's 6'1", and he needs all this space, and he's pushing me around. And then the show starts, and I sit back down, and my cord's all tangled up. I spilled the coffee all over the floor, and, you know, Chris Brook isn't going to be happy about this. Do we have, like, some... Do we have, like, a Swiffer wet jet or something? Because...
I think you need a Swiffer for that. It's a carpet. Yeah. I thought that's for
floors. Headphones are covered in coffee right now.
You know, there's a clean pair of headphones right over here.
Yeah, but I didn't have time. The show was starting.
I just see it dripping on your head right now. That's great.
Remus is coming through in the clutch with some paper towels to save the day here. Anyways, the Dallas theme song was just being played, and that's because the Dallas Stars hired a new head coach in Lindy Ruff, ex of the Buffalo Sabres. You know, looking at this hire, I mean, Lindy Ruff certainly spent, what, 15 years in Buffalo, something like that?
He's only like 52. That was when I was surprised. I thought he was older.
Well, he looks older because he's got sort of the, you know, it's been around forever. That we make
he coached in Buffalo for so long, but he's also the assistant coach in Florida before that. When they made the run to the finals.
The year that they got swept by Colorado.
Yeah, so I'm actually surprised he's young. Yeah, he's younger than Tortorella.
Is Lindy Ruff the right hire in Dallas?
You know, obviously they wanted Vigneault.
Yeah.
And they offered basically the same money, 5-year, $10 million, to coach in Dallas. And he decided to go to the Rangers. And I understand that because, you know, I think they have a better chance to win now. Lindy Ruff's a solid coach, guys. I think he's, you know, he was in Buffalo for so long. I think at some point it just, they grew apart. But he's well-respected. I'm a little bit I'm interested in this regard. Lindy Ruff's coached talented teams before. I think his best work is done with, you know, rugged teams and or working hard and or exceeding expectations. I kind of see him in the Mike Babcock way though here with Jim Neal goes into Dallas, and we've had Ken Holland on our NHL Midweek show, and he kind of said, you know, we asked him, what was the biggest adjustment Mike Babcock had to make as coach in Detroit? And he said, well, you know, Mike Babcock always wanted to play a north-south game when he came here from Anaheim. And what we had to talk to him about was that sometimes you got to play an east-west game as well. And I think Ruff will understand that a little bit more because of the teams he's had, and Drury and Connolly and Briere and all that stuff. But I think he's more of a north-south guy. And I think Jim Neal, coming from Detroit, probably sees an east-west side to the game as well. So and I think the roster's built, already signing Gonchar, having some speed and skill on the roster. How does he adjust to that? And I think if he adjusts well, which I think he has changed over the course of time, I think this is a really good fit. I think he demands respect in the locker room. I think he will get it. And I think it's a good move.
You know what I like? There's a Winnipeg Jets, Buffalo Sabres connection. Stu Barnes is an assistant coach, and he has been retained to be Lindy Ruff's assistant coach. I think it's a good hire. I've always liked Lindy Ruff. There's a reason why Lindy Ruff was in Buffalo for so long, and there's a reason why that David Poile kept Barry Trotz for so long. Mm-hmm. He's still the coach. These guys are good hockey coaches, and I like Stefan Robidoux was quoted about the Lindy Ruff hiring, and he basically said, I like the hiring. He was my coach for Team Canada at the mm-hmm. World Championships, and he said he's no nonsense, and he wants you to work hard. And we don't really know enough about Glenn Gullitson to really give judgments about you know, his job as a coach, because all accounts are that he's a smart hockey guy. But Jim Neal decided that he wasn't the guy to lead this team. He wanted to bring in a guy who's got, as you said, 15 years of NHL head coaching experience. But all the players that have been interviewed have said that they like the hire. And, you know, I actually think it's a better hire than Alain Vigneault. I like Lindy Ruff better as a coach. I mean, everybody looks at Alain Vigneault and they say, oh, well, he won the President's Trophy and the Canucks won the division every year. And, you know, we should get him in Winnipeg. Well, what is he going to do with a team that isn't laden with all that offensive talent? Doesn't have the Sedins, doesn't have the Kesslers. Sure, they've got lots of talent in Dallas. You know, Jamie Benn, Cody Eakin, all these guys. They've brought in Gonchar. Good goal. Lettinen was good last year. But, you know, he's one of those guys that I think his players want to play for him. Yeah. I think he's one of those guys. He's more of a player's coach than definitely Tortorella, and probably even more so than Vigneault. I like the hire.
And for, you know, you can't bring Tortorella into that team with not great expectations. You bring Ruff in, and you know it's a process. Mm-hmm. And he knows it's a process, too. Buffalo, they couldn't contend every year, and I think Ruff is a better suited to that role.
Well, you know, this is sort of more of a... I mean, I don't think it's too simplistic to say that the downfall of Ruff in Buffalo was strictly when the purse strings opened up and they had the new ownership. But, you know, you look at the Dallas market, and, you know, I think it's sort of, there are some similarities. It'll sort of be under the radar there, you know, and he can just do his thing with the team and not have to worry about everything else. And there's not a great ton of expectations there. Right. It's just a team that's got some good core pieces that he can sort of mold into an identity. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and it seems like, you know, he'd be a good coach to shape an identity with.
Drew, I should mention, Stu Barnes used to be an assistant with the Stars. James Patrick is the guy that it looks like Lindy Ruff might bring in to Dallas. James Patrick was an assistant with Buffalo from Winnipeg. Everybody, if you remember him, he was a defenseman in the NHL, so I got to just correct myself. Stu Barnes is no longer an assistant in Dallas, but he has to add another guy. Kurt Fraser is the other assistant there, so I just wanted to point that out, that it looks like James Patrick could be joining him.
Okay. Dave Tippett staying in Phoenix, surprised at all?
Well, he's got an opt-out after every year, it appears. So, I mean, if he doesn't like where the team's going, literally. Then he can opt out. So I'm not surprised he trusts Don Maloney. He's got a good relationship. The management has a good relationship with him. He knows the team. He's got control. So I wouldn't be shocked to see him, not last the whole time. Because I don't think Phoenix lasts there. And then we can see. Maybe he's happy to go to a different place. But Jay Tippett's done a really nice job there. And he's getting paid pretty well, too. So
apparently Tippett's getting the same money that Vigneault got in New York. And you got to figure that money is just for being such a loyal foot soldier to the NHL.
Well, I'm sure Bill Daly signed that check. So,
yeah.
Because that's who they answer to.
Right. So, I mean,
it's not Renaissance Sports and Entertainment.
The only other owner's got to be going, like, I mean, we're not talking about this, but the other owner's got to be going, like,
how much longer?
We're paying this much for a coach. I'm paying you to coach another team.
I heard Warren Buffett's going to buy the Coyotes.
I think you were just at a buffet.
That's right. It said buffet.
And there's a warrant out for your arrest.
Yeah. This is almost had that. You know, very close. Anyways, let's go to break. When we come back, Michael Farber is going to join us to talk about a new TSN documentary that's premiering on Tuesday. It's called Neutral Zone. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. 1 hour down, 2 hours to go on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and the website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You know his work from Sports Illustrated. You know his work from TSN, the reporters. He's a Hockey Hall of Fame journalist, Michael Farber. Michael, good afternoon, and thank you for joining us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Gentlemen, my pleasure.
New TSN documentary, it's going to debut on Tuesday. It's called Neutral Zone, and it has to do with the Canada-Israel Hockey School, which is something that the three of us in the room happen to be quite familiar with, having interviewed the Canada-Israel Hockey School was actually doing a tour of Winnipeg a number of months ago, so we had the pleasure to interview the head coach, Mike Mascheka. We've actually all visited the school or been to the facility in Matula before. You know, can you tell our audience sort of about the Canada-Israel Hockey School and what their mandate is?
Well, the mission of the Canada-Israel Hockey School is to get children playing hockey, but also to integrate on teams Jewish Israeli children and Arab Israeli children so they can not only learn the sport, but they can learn something about each other. The stories that interest me as a journalist are not just the scores of games. It's sport as an instrument for social change, what we can learn about ourselves and the world through sport. A couple of years ago for Sports Illustrated, I was in Belfast writing about a hockey team in the British League there that tries to bridge the gap between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. And this is a similar kind of story, but it's done with children, and it's a certainly a noble undertaking. I think it's a very ambitious program. Will it succeed? It depends on how you measure success, but certainly it can't hurt.
Was that the main attraction to this story for you, Michael?
It was proposed to me by Josh Scheinman, who was is the producer of this, and he does all the heavy lifting. That's how it works in TV. He called me last November, I believe it was, and would I have any interest? And yeah, I would. I thought it was a good story to tell. We were promised excellent access, and it, we certainly, the people in Israel lived up to their end of the bargain. So we got to a lot of places. We were in the Golan Heights. We were in actually in a town called Rajar, which is half Lebanese and half Israeli. It's remarkable places. And so this was Josh's story, and I was privileged enough to be invited along for the ride.
Michael, how are kids getting involved in this Canada-Israel Hockey School? Is there a waiting list, or what's the process to be selected into this hockey school?
Well, you sign up, and one of the great advantages of it is it's underwritten by people in this country, to a large extent by Sidney Greenberg, the media magnate. People, the NHL and the NHLPA have donated jerseys. The Jewish communities throughout Canada have supported this program. So the cost for the parents or the kids is quite minimal. Ice time is ice time. We know what it costs in Montreal and Winnipeg and Toronto. It's not easily affordable, but this is literally dollars a month. So it's an activity in Matula, which is in the very northern tip of the country, surrounded by Lebanon, so close that I was awakened each morning by the call to prayers from the mosque in another country, which is kind of a cool thing. That's never happened to me before. And so it's an activity that kids can do for very little. Parents like it because it's a healthy activity. Mm-hmm. They get their kids moving, active. They're learning a new game, one that's not organic to the area, obviously. And it also fulfills some larger social missions. So the parents have been quite supportive.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're joined by Hockey Hall of Fame journalist Michael Farber, who is involved in a new documentary that's going to premiere on Tuesday on TSN. It's called Neutral Zone, and it talks about hockey in Israel and the bringing together of Jewish kids and Arab kids to play hockey. Michael, while filming the documentary, you know, what did you find most impactful? What resonated most for you while being on the ground in Israel?
I think it was the friendships that were developing among the children. And specifically, I think girls were drawn closer. Maybe 12-year-old girls are more expressive about their feelings. But part of the documentary focuses on two girls. So one, a girl named Noy Rosenberg, who lived in a kibbutz about 15 minutes from Matula. And another girl named Bassan Marie, she's a Druze, an Arab girl, mm-hmm. from the Golan Heights, from a town called Majdal Shams. And they basically have become best friends. And that's very obvious by the way they behave towards each other. Noy is a forward, Bassan is a goalie, and as Noy says, she's the best goalie in the history of hockey. And it's nice to see how they respond to each other. It's not like they go visit each other in their homes. And they're not friends that way, but they're at the rink. They jump into each other's arms. They're so happy to see each other. They do the social media things that 12-year-old girls and 13-year-old girls do pretty much anywhere, I would imagine. And to see something like that, I was very impressed about how open and genuine it all was.
You know, Michael, they came into town through here, and we saw them play. I caught them at the MTS Iceplex here, play a Sunday morning game against a local team. And it kind of seemed to me that, similar to hockey, you know, the NHL level, they were building on being on traveling together. You know, when you're away from everything at home, you only really have each other, and that builds relationships even more. So for people to be financing these trips, it seemed like only to serve that purpose even better.
That's an excellent point. And we always talk about NHL teams bonding. Lots of teams at the start of the year will go and have some kind of group activity to get everybody on the same page. Well, these girls went to Finland last year, and boys as well. And I think there was also a trip to Ottawa. And these trips, when you're forced to room with somebody who you don't know very well, might be a teammate, but it's someone you don't know, and then you have to talk, and you have to get to understand each other. And so these trips are all part of the process. And so they've been able to do that, and for a lot of them, it's been the first time out of the country. Israel's not the easiest place right. to get in or out of. You just don't drive. It's not like leaving Manitoba and driving to, I don't know, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't happen that way. I suppose you can drive to Jordan, but there's not a lot of places right. Israeli kids can go. So when being flown to Finland or being flown to Canada, it's a big deal. And the United States, a group of them were in Los Angeles just before the Winnipeg trip. So it does bring the kids closer together, and we spoke to several children about that. The problem was the parents, who were very wary of their children rooming with kids from the other side of the geopolitical divide.
Michael, Neutral Zone debuts Tuesday night on TSN, and we have you on right now, so there's nobody better to ask about it, and I'm really excited about this documentary. You know, as we mentioned, we've all been to Matula, fortunate enough to be up there and see the hockey rink, the Canada Center there. As far as the documentary goes, what would you say are people going to you know, look forward to most, and what about this documentary should people be the most excited for?
Well, I think people across the country can say, gee, this is what some Canadians are doing to help. And I think there should be some kind of sense of pride in this. And certainly what the communities throughout Canada have done for this, what Sidney Greenberg has done, it's a quixotic notion, really. And sometimes you wonder if ambition's not too great. Can you change the world, make it more peaceful through what is essentially a violent game, hockey? And can sport itself be used as a vehicle for social change? So it's really up for viewers to decide what they take away from it. I will tell you about a father of an Israeli soldier, member of the Israeli Defense Forces. His son was killed in the 2006 war with Lebanon. And he does not sponsor a team, but his son is honored with his name on the jersey of a team. And for him to watch Arab kids and Jewish kids, Jewish-Israeli kids play together, it's quite moving and creates a certain amount of conflict. And I think you'll be quite moved by his story.
Michael, we'll let you go on this last question. Again, the documentary is called Neutral Zone. On Tuesday, it'll debut on TSN. And really, you mentioned it, and it's the parents interactions that really, you know, interest me the most, because, you know, you like to think, or, you know, as society, we like to think that, you know, kids have to be indoctrinated to disliking one another, that, you know, ultimately, you know, when they're born, people, the kids want to get along with other people. They have to it's a learned behavior to dislike one another, to get involved in a conflict. You know, what was the interaction like between the parents of the Israeli children and the parents of the Arab children on the hockey teams? Because they would be through the, I mean, they would have the history. They would know the background of everything that has to go on in the country of Israel.
Minimal. Contacts, minimal. Parents tend to stay on different sides of the stands. And they're not typical hockey parents, mm-hmm. Because the game is so foreign. So it's cliquish. It's not particularly warm. But that kind of struggle isn't going to be won on the level of the parents, as you suggest. This will be done on the level of the children. And I think it's the children who make the story so compelling.
Michael Farber, Hockey Hall of Fame journalist, TSN's The Reporter, Sports Illustrated. Thank you very much for joining us. You're doing some important work there, bringing this story to Canada and you know, the all the good work that the Canada-Israel Hockey Center is doing there in Israel and worldwide.
Well, I appreciate the time. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Okay.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Thank you to Michael Farber for having joined us. Very much looking forward to that documentary Tuesday on TSN. It's called Neutral Zone. You know, like I said, like we said in the interview, a place that we've all been before and an organization that we had the opportunity to interview here on this program. So looking forward to seeing it broadcast for a national audience on TSN. We're going to be joined by Frank Provenzano, former assistant general manager to the Dallas Stars, momentarily here. Talk a little bit about the upcoming free agency, and I'm getting the thumbs up from Remus in the other room so that you know what that means.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Frank Provenzano. Frank, good afternoon. Thanks very much for joining us.
No problem, guys. Good afternoon to you guys.
Frank, you know, we want to talk to you sort of, it's, you know, with this compacted season, it's really just a whirlwind. We go straight from the cup to the draft to the free agency. So we sort of wanted to talk to you both about the draft and the free agency and sort of the machinations behind the scenes about how everything comes together in those two time periods in the NHL schedule. You know, first question, you know, prior to the free agency period opening up, how many meetings does a typical organization have to make sure that their ducks are all in a row for when the ball officially drops on the free agency period?
I think the process really starts, you know, in a normal season. We're not going to use last season as an example because it was obviously an asterisk season. But normally, you know, you'd get your season up and running in October and get the first 20 or so games under your belt and have a meeting with your pro scouts sometime in around either December or early January, and sort of identify the areas that of weakness of your team, and to identify players that, you know, may be moving on through free agency, etc. Also, based on, you know, you have a pretty good chance of seeing where your minor league team is at that point in terms of the development of some of your young players in terms of internal replacements. And then you sort of monitor it going into the trade deadline. Obviously, you're going to meet again for the purposes of the trade deadline, but then part of that meeting after the trade deadline is, okay, now let's focus on potential free agents. And then you'll meet probably after the season in May, and then again at the draft, because like you said, everyone thinks of the draft as sort of, you know, the main focus is on selecting amateur players, but it's really, there's so much going on in addition to that, because it's the only time of the year when the whole hockey world's together.
Frank, you know, how do you think the new pre-free agency communication period, the I think July 2nd through July 5th, how do you think that will change free agency?
Yeah, I think it's the 3rd and the 4th. I'm not sure if the 2nd is part of that, but regardless, I think, you know, there's two areas where I guess it can change it, in that the sort of the marquee free agents, where you have the kind of the teams lining up to, you know, do the kind of the dog and pony show pitches on why they should come there. Typically, at least in the past, those teams, if they were doing that and trying to get a Brad Richards or Parise, it was kind of taking them out of all the other free agents to a certain degree. So I think part of it is you can get that part of it sort of done for teams that are after the marquee guys. It'll give them a sense of where maybe they stand, whereas when free agency actually opens, they can go a little more aggressively to their plan B guys. And then I think the other area where maybe the biggest area that'll change is I think you'll see a lot more RFAs maybe doing the rounds of interviewing teams, because you can't block guys out. My understanding is you can't block guys out of restricted free agency now by the club electing electing arbitration on them. So, you know, maybe you'll see a lot more restricted free agents going and talking to teams and with the thought of getting an offer sheet, whether it's a negotiating tactic or not. That's one area that I think you might see more of.
Frank, we're about 8 days away from the NHL draft in Newark at the Prudential Center, and everyone's expecting trades to happen either on draft day, before draft day, or at least trades are going to be consummated. But we want to ask you about the process, because you've been on that draft floor, and we wanted to ask you, you know, when a draft day trades, you know, whether it's 2011, you know, the Brent Burns trade between the Wild and the Sharks, even though you weren't involved in that trade, but just for an example, you know, are those draft trades strictly consummated by communication on the draft floor versus, you know, conversations that might have happened before the draft?
Usually a trade that is strictly, you know, conceived and transacted on the draft floor usually only involves picks and maybe prospects. If you're involving NHL players, I would say almost always, well, there are obviously exceptions, but almost always there was, you know, quite a bit of talk going into the draft. This week, coming up is a very heavy week in terms of discussions amongst general managers, maybe as heavy in some respects as the week leading into the trade deadline, because every team is shuffling the deck to a certain degree in terms of setting its roster next year, making the changes that they feel they need to make. And so there is a lot of discussion going on, you know, amongst GMs about moving players. Some players have trade clauses that kick in on July 1st. Some have trade clauses that go away on July 1st. They're trying to make decisions on whether to buy players out or not. The wrinkle this year is, do we buy a player or do we try and trade him for a percentage of his money? So to wait until the draft is probably a strategy that's going to limit you as opposed to help you make a trade. And as a result, most of these discussions are going on, you know, now or soon.
You're listening to TSN 1290. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, and we're joined by former Dallas Stars assistant general manager Frank Provenzano. Frank, we know that the general manager, you know, has a big say and a heavy say in a team's first round draft pick. After that pick, and then in the, you know, the later rounds, the second, third, and onwards, how much does the GM, you know, how much involvement does the GM have, and how much is he strictly relying on his scouts and the scouting reports?
You know, obviously it changes, you know, it's different team by team depending on the GM, but I would say for the most part, very little. Unless it, for whatever reason, the GM, you know, has a particularly strong feeling about it, say a second round pick in terms of the player he may know or not. But usually you're going with your people in the first round as well, but definitely in the second round. And as you get in the later rounds, your head of amateur scouting at that point is even relying on his regional people or his area people to step up and make selections. So I would say as you go down in the rounds, the sort of responsibility gets more diffuse throughout the staff.
Frank, we wanted to ask you about the process of signing free agents and when you offer an unrestricted free agent a contract, because we're going to be talking about unrestricted free agency a little bit later and who some of the guys might be available later this summer. But as far as you know, the process of offering a guy a contract, in this day and age, does that happen mainly by phone, by email? How does that process work, you know, in a kind of a typical situation?
Generally speaking, you come up with a financial number that you think is the outer limit and a term that's the maximum you're willing to do, and you add $1 million per year and add a couple of years, and then you're there.
It's that easy.
You know, usually you're doing it by phone just because to do it in person, you run it, particularly with respect to the free agency, you just don't have enough time. Now, again, if it's a marquee free agent that is sort of holding, you know, holding court or receiving suitors at his agent's compound, you know, then you're probably going to send a delegation. But for the vast majority of free agents, you know, having done that job, I did it for 14 years, you know most of the agents, you've dealt with them before, you pick up the phone, and you just say, hey, you know, we're interested in player so-and-so. If you're prepared to make an offer right there, you make it. If you're not prepared to make an offer because maybe you have an offer out somewhere else on a similar player, but if you don't get that player, you want to indicate interest to sort of keep that warm, so to speak, then you do that.
Are there cases, Frank, where, say, you know, for example, a team wants a second or first line, you know, maybe a 1B center, and Derek Roy's available, and they need a center, and Stephen Weiss is available. Will there be times where you tender offers at the same time, and if that's the case, would you tell the other player that there's another offer out there, and if that's accepted, yours is off the table?
I mean, as a general rule, and everyone's different, I guess, I always try to have one offer, and you know, in the cases of multiples, you'd have multiple interests in one offer. If you can, you do want to be upfront and say, if you have two offers out there, you just tell, you know, the agent, say, look, you know, I like your guy. You know, we have interest in your player, and here's what we're prepared to do. But we also have the same offer out to a similar player, and whoever calls us back first is the guy we're taking, because you obviously have two.
Right.
And so you just sort of manage it that way. It's more art than science, because it's a crazy day. There was a 2 years ago, I think, where we had we had a bunch of spots to fill, and we had to get to the floor, as did Florida, I think, that same year.
Right.
And so you sort of identify not only the players and that fill your needs, but then you're trying to also match them to this sort of arbitrary, this floor number that you got to manage. You don't want to grossly overpay so that if it doesn't work, you can still move the asset, but you also have to make sure you spend enough
right.
to get to the floor. So, you know, you don't know if you're going to get the players, because they're doing the same thing to you, saying, well, you know, thanks, he's interested, but there's a couple other offers, and it's sort of that whole back and forth. So it does happen where you might have two offers out there, but you really want to, if you do have that, you got to be careful that you don't end up in the situation you had indicated, where you end up with two players.
Right, yeah. And, you know, Frank, final question here. You talked about kind of the agents and the relationships, but you hear a lot about it, maybe more so in other sports. You know, certain teams won't deal with Scott Boras clients, and they just don't do it. Does that happen at all in hockey circles, and how important is that agent general manager relationship?
I think relationships are extremely important. It's one of the things that I learned, and you know, the 14 years that I did it is you have to take the long view sometimes and say, you know, I sort of change my style over the years to come up with a fair deal, because at the end of the day, if it was too wildly weighted to one side or the other, in the long run, it didn't work anyway.
Right.
And so you do build a relationship with agents if you treat them fairly, that you can pick up the phone and cut right to the chase, because really on that day, you know, on the first wave of free agency where you're trying to get the premium free agents, it is a cut to the chase day. I mean, by 2 o'clock or whatever, you know, 3 or 4 hours into it, you know, a lot of the players are gone that have the most interest. So I think the relationship is important with the GM and the agent, or whoever is negotiating on behalf of the team, whether it's the assistant GM or the GM. I think for that matter, the relationships are more important than ever because of the salary cap. You know, the money is going to be, in most cases, what it's going to be.
Right.
And so then what it comes down to is, okay, well, is it a relationship? What tips the balance? And a lot of times it is that.
Frank Provenzano, former assistant general manager of the Dallas Stars, thanks always for joining us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Some great insight into the machinations of the NHL behind the scenes.
Anytime, guys.
Thanks very much, Frank.
Bye.
Let's go to break, and I suspect we're going to hear about it because we've been keeping Rick Ralph on hold this whole time. So let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.